Welcome to the Say What podcast, where we're not just speaking, but also listening. To be the first to get new episodes, subscribe and follow the channel. I'm your host, Jacob Browning, lead pastor at First Salina in North Texas. Well, the sermon title from yesterday was Shining Our Light, entering into a new section of the Lord's teaching on the topic of motivation. We were in Matthew chapter 6, verses 1 through 4, and we had three teaching points: motivated by God's righteousness, distracted by man's reward, and motivated by God's recognition. Once again, audience, thank you so much. We've got some engaging questions, and I got the team with me here again, and I can't wait to dialogue. So, Michael.
Yeah. Hey, the first one is applicable to everybody, and it goes like this. Do you think we need to minimize social media or be more truthful in what we are posting? Should we be more willing to share our struggles?
I think social media can be like a silver lining moment, right? Like, I think the short answer to both of these questions is yes. I think all of us who are on social media could probably be on it less. And then also, should we be more vulnerable? Yes. Not necessarily you have to say everything that went wrong or give us pictures of your dirty laundry room. Not necessarily all that, but they're too curated most of the time. It's not authentic.
There's plenty of posts that I see that are truthful, but they're not very kind. Or they're not tasteful. Truthful and tasteful are two different things.
This is one of those topics where sometimes I feel like I'm way out here on an island, whether it be for because of my lack of media and my background and my upbringing. And I feel sometimes like a social pariah when it comes to social media. Look me up, you'll find very little. So on these topics, I get a little worried because I don't want to come off as some sort of dinosaur. And I also don't want to come off in a way that I'm being judgmental of people who are active on social media. But I think that social media, those two words together, is kind of an oxymoron. Whenever you think about social, I mean, we are a tribal species, human beings are. Like, we should get a lot of comfort from being together. We're herd animals, we human beings are. And God's made us that way because we desire relationship, because even within the one God, there's the Father, there's the Son, there's the Holy Spirit. So a part of being made in God's image is that we were made for each other. There's a reality to the social sphere and how much comfort that should provide. But the purpose of media is consuming. Any kind of media, any media company, their bottom line is consumers. So when you have social, which is made for comfort, and you've got media, which is made for consuming, putting those together feels like they're not destined to ever go together. I'm not here to make hot takes or to make anybody feel bad about their social media or having one, but I will say that whenever you have two words like that that are sandwiched together and you don't really think much about the words themselves, you're kind of going into a buzzsaw a little bit. There's a higher likelihood you're going to get it wrong than get it right. So I bracketed this question into two different parts. The first part being, do you think we need to minimize social media? Well, if I'm going to be consistent, based off what I just said about social media, that I even believe the two words put together is oxymoronic, then I believe you should minimize that thing. And the second part, or should we be more truthful in what we are posting? Well, let it never be said of anybody that's associated with First Salina, and maybe even chiefly the pastor. I would never advocate for being more dishonest on social media, like if you're on it. So, or be more truthful in what we're posting. I think the heart here is clarified when it says about sharing struggles. I feel like the social media craze began to heighten with the very low cost threshold for relationships. Like even we hear people qualify friendships with, well, I have social media friends, I have Facebook friends, I have Instagram friends. And it's almost like there's a separate category because friend doesn't mean friend anymore.
Right.
What was that great song that talked about friendships? Somebody to lean on me. The problem is that that does not in any way describe social media. But isn't that the definition of friendship? Somebody you can lean on whenever you're not strong?
Yeah.
We live in a day to where it's all about being keyboard warriors, that there's more people online that are ready to tear you down than to be that stronghold you lean up against. That's the worst possible place to voice your struggles. There are simply not people there online that care. All you're doing is putting out for anybody in the world to see what you're going through, whenever that should be the safe space for friends. Social media will not take the place of your deep need for friendships, someone to lean on. So I would not advocate, if what you mean by being more truthful, not online, but yes, find a friend. Go to a coffee. Take your kids to the playground and let them go swing from the monkey bars and talk while you're there watching them. You know, join a club sport. Join a fraternity or a sorority. Have an actual friend that you're going to look in the eye. That's where you share your struggles, not into looking into a screen and type in and out.
Yeah, we're here. We'll be your friend.
We'll be your friend. We have connect groups for this very reason. Come to First Solana.
I think it's important for us to remember, it's kind of like social media is kind of like texting. You can't always discern the heart of the person texting. A lot of times it's read with our own bent and our own frustration or just what's happening that day. You have to be so careful and you have to be so discerning of what you put online. Therefore, you got to at a certain point go, is this worth it? And like, wouldn't it be better if I was just interacting with this person in person?
Well, it goes back to you having that relationship. Mm-hmm. Even close friends that I have, that we have, you know, sometimes we text, we're like, oh, I'm not really sure what they mean by that. But if it's a total stranger, how more so is that? You
right
know,
point.
It's always a good idea, the best idea, to try and have those established relationships, to your point, though.
I mean, it's called a platform for a reason, but I think it's another sphere of influence where we just have to be really conscientious about whatever we're sharing and whatever we're saying. I mean, it ultimately needs to be for His glory. And if it's not glorifying, then we don't need to post it. Like, I use it more of a diary of pictures of my kids than I do anything else. But I also follow a lot of people that have really cool things to say, and they are sharing that with thousands and thousands of people. I'm also really tempted to shop more than I need to because I get targeted ads, okay? So I have to be very careful of my mindset and when I'm just needing to get off, you know? I mean, you can be very discontent very quickly if you spend a lot of time on social media, whether it's the things you want that you can't have or the things that you see that you think other people have that you want. And so there's a maturity factor I think we have to weigh into what that's doing to us and recognize when it's time to get off.
I agree. And, you know, I think there is a redemptive way to post about a struggle. Let's say that I am coming out of a struggle. Important, coming out of a struggle. Not going into one or midway through one, but I'm coming out of a struggle. And I think that this struggle is probably had by more people. I want to tell them what was helpful. And let's say that I go on to that struggle and I post and I say, my good friend Michael Robbins, he shared this with me. And I'm so very grateful for my church family. I'm so very grateful for my friend. What it shows is that there's a close-endedness to the conversation that I'm sharing the struggle. This is what helped me and maybe it will help you. You're not soliciting advice from the mindless keyboard warriors out there who either just want to speak fake affirmations or tear you down with critique. So a way to talk about those struggles, it would be that, hey, I'm coming out of this and this is what really helped me. Shout out to my friend who I had sat with and told these things to, and I know that he loves me and we worked through this together. That could be a really redemptive way to post about that, because you're not asking advice from people who don't love you. In fact, you're bragging on the one who did, and it could be a massive encouragement to, in this example, Michael Robbins, who he might not even know that it made that big of a difference. This is something that can be a great light in a dark world, the way that kingdom people, the way that Christians can comfort one another. I think that could be a very redemptive way to go about posting.
When I think of social media, I've had social media my whole life. Like, I was on MySpace when I was in grade school. So, like, all I know my entire life, I know, I'm the only one under 30. My parents didn't know I was on MySpace. I was on there by myself. Social media has been a part of my entire life. And so, as Cody had mentioned, you see people post about struggles or things they're going through. And I think you can kind of tell their heart in it. I think there's a lot of people who will post wanting validation. But what they really need is healing. Mm. You're not going to get that by posting on social media. You may get that validation, but not the healing that you truly need. And what you need is people to walk alongside you, like what's already been said, but you're not going to get people walking alongside you through social media in the comment section of things. That's going to be a community. That's going to be a church. That's going to be people that are going to come along and rally alongside of you in whatever struggle or difficult time you're going through. If you were to go look at my social media platform, you would think I had the best life ever. It's all about family pictures, vacations, marriage, anniversaries, all that stuff, right? I'm not posting the bad or the hardships of my life. And so could I be more truthful on social media? Maybe. But I think it would be in a way, like Pastor Jacob had said, of like, hey, I've been through this, and this is a way you can get through it too. The point of it is to encourage other people. I think that's the heart of what we need to get to when we're posting struggles. Are we posting it for validation? Or are we posting it to be like, hey, you can get through this too. This is how I did it, and ultimately pointing to Jesus. And so I think the answer to the question is yes and yes. You could minimize social media, and yeah, you could be more truthful on social media, but it's got to be to the glory of God.
Yeah, I even would take that a step further. How much, like how you just described our interactions in social media, how much does that mirror our interactions in person in the church sometimes, where it's just a highlight reel? We're not being real with people. I would say the discernment we need for the social media stuff and the concern we need to show the truth is just as real of a thing for our in-person interactions. Mm-hmm. And it's so easy to hide those things.
Another perspective I was sitting here thinking about with social media, Anna was talking about a journal for kids and family. You know, we've moved all over. A lot of our family, all of our family is on the other side of the country. Half of the friends we have in our life are on the other side of the country. And so it's encouraging to be able to keep up with those folks, you know, on social media. But it's kind of like everything else. I think we're all saying it's all moderation and it's all balancing. What are you using that platform for?
No longer, because of the unique time we live in history and because of this amazing technology, are my friendships determined by proximity. That's a brand new thing in human history. Yeah. So I think that alone is worth a lot of value, and why we shouldn't just wholesale go, nah, it has no value whatsoever. That's not true. But I confess that I do lean towards it. I see so many people that I care about a lot that just have such a hard time navigating a healthy relationship with it. And I admit that a lot of those people are younger, 20s, 30s, teenagers. So until you have that maturity, it's hard for it not to tell you who you are rather than you telling it what it's going to be.
Yeah, because I think what the problem is when people are posting for this validation, they're wanting to be lifted up, but through those comments, they get torn down so much. In my generation, one of the common phrases you'll see on social media whenever there's a video or something that's posted, it's the idea of running to the comments.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And then that's what happens when people post real life struggles that are hard. I mean, really hard. People say some really mean or not uplifting things. And honestly, our society enjoys that. And so it's another reason of, hey, maybe we shouldn't post those things out there when we're hoping to be lifted up, when people are going to unfortunately tear us down. There's a better way about going about it.
Can we have a quick, honest just assessment of things? I want to make sure that I'm not way off in la-la land. And if I am, I'm sure that the team's going to help me and bring me back into the real world. And what I'm about to say, teenagers, if you're listening to this, this is not a critique. It's not a critique. But as a teenager, is there anything you're doing as a teenager that's not for validation? Like, aren't you figuring out adulthood for the very first time? Aren't you little by little, day by day, offering up these ideas, these suggestions, these behaviors, and you're trying to figure out where does this fit in society? And you're either operating off of that was validated or that was invalid and I shouldn't do that. Like, maybe more so than ever, as development takes root in who you are during your teenage years, isn't everything about validation? Ergo, social media is one of the biggest no-go zones. Mm-hmm. Like, you see what I'm trying to do here? Like, I'm telling you, teenage me, every single day I was seeking validation. I didn't know it then, but looking back, I was. And that's normal. And it's, hello, okay. So as a teenager, know where you're getting your validation. If you have a buddy or you have a friend who is always in trouble, that person on your list of people to seek validation from should be very low on the list. But as you look at people that are maybe that next stage ahead of you, who's crushing it, doing well in a space that you want to be in, that's someone that needs to give you some validation. But of all these places, and of course, first and foremost, your parents, the people you know love you, like that's where you need to get your validation. Hey, your church should be high on your validation credibility. Social media? Hey, no wonder so many struggle with it. No wonder teenage suicides are skyrocketing at the exact same time as the social media proliferation. So, it's not exactly something that we should just, you know, act like it in a reality that, hey, teenagers out there, it's okay if you're seeking a lot of validation. There's only one way to realize how to be an adult, through testing. But the validation game is a dangerous game to play whenever it's with people you don't love. Social media puts you in contact with tens of thousands of people who do not love you. And they will have a lot to say about who to be, not to be, that looks good on you, that looks terrible on you. Oh, why'd you do this? You look this way. Awesome job. Don't stop. Keep going, girl. Boy, don't stop. All the stuff. But if they don't love you, don't listen.
One of the great things about having this podcast is an opportunity to interact with people who ask questions. And just to let you guys know, the audience, there are several questions that just kind of align. Every week, people are asking similar things. And so I know we had other questions that asked about social media. I really think we've answered them, at least from our perspective and trying to give this biblical perspective. So I want to move on to the next question, which is a pretty big shift. And Cody, this one, you might be able to speak into this, at least to start. But let me give the context that they give before I ask it. It says this, Matthew 5:16 calls us to let our light shine before others so that they may glorify God. And the reason they're using this verse, because it was used in the sermon on Sunday, and they say, how might this connect with the practice of worshiping in a dark sanctuary, especially when we gather with fellow believers and want a younger generation to see the joy on our faces as we praise Him? And this question kind of comes in the middle of their context. It says this, does the darkness help us focus on God in a unique way, or could it sometimes make it harder to reflect the light we're called to share?
I don't know that this is a question that can be answered. It's more of a stylistic preference that can be debated, because you've got one side of the aisle that wants to walk into a room that's lit up 100% of the time. You've got another side of the aisle that isn't very comfortable in being lit up. They're not comfortable raising their hands. They're not comfortable having an intimate moment with the Lord. And really, you know, as a worship team, I mean, that's really what we're doing. We're pointing people to Christ. Pastor Jacob, you talked about this earlier this week. That we are vertically focused, and that's what we're doing. We're pointing people upward. We're pointing people in the direction that they can have an intimate experience with the Lord in whatever way that looks like. you know, the lights are not off. All, and I say off, they're never off. Rarely are they off. I think the last time the lights were off in worship was Easter, actually. And that was for a dramatic effect. And often that's what we do with lights. We use lights as a tool, just like any other instrument, any other element, whether it's media-driven or not. We use those things to creatively explore, creatively share the gospel. And so sometimes the lights are dim, sometimes the lights are up. You know, a lot of times the lights will follow kind of the mood of the song. That's pretty normal. I don't know. There is a very compelling argument to have the lights turned up all the time for everything, you know, but there's also a lot of great reasons why, you know, it may be a good idea to turn them down a little bit and to point people to, you know, what's happening on the stage, what's going on the screen, the words of the song that's there, drawing their attention and centering their attention in the room.
This is definitely not all on Cody. Cody and I, in particular, we meet every week and we work through all the elements of the worship service because we really want to put a lot of thought into the whole experience that happens here at First Salina, because God is worthy of that critical thought. He's worthy of that brainstorming. So Cody and I have a separate meeting about this every single week. And maybe some of you have noticed this, maybe you haven't. And now if I work through it, I bet you'll notice it from now till the end of time. The first song that the worship team is doing is always a call to worship song. The reason that's the case is because the doors are always wide open. And the biblical framework for this is think about the Psalms of Ascent. So your family cohort, as you were approaching temple worship, you'd be singing the Psalms of Ascent. Now, I'm sure that Google will help me on this, but if I remember right, those are Psalms 120 through 134, if I'm not mistaken. But I'm sure that anybody that has access right now to Google can tell me what exactly those psalms are. Now, the Psalms of Ascent is because the temple is on the Temple Mount. They would be ascending, getting closer and closer, and they would be singing these songs as a family cohort traveling to do worship. That's the whole framework of our call to worship song. It's one song at the top of the hour. The doors are open. They're being sung as people are entering into the worship center. Then we want to make reference to any person that we have the honor of hosting, and that's whenever we give out our honey that Cody does an amazing job of getting visitors to raise their hand in a room full of strangers. It's amazing your ability to do that, because you would expect that no one would want to do that. And maybe the rumors about how good the honey is out too. So however we get them here, praise Jesus, they're here. But immediately after that, there's the call to worship. The call to worship is the call for the vertical focus of the room. Again, the vertical focus of the room. God has given us a lot of land and a big building here in North Texas, and I'm grateful for that. But that worship center, that room is unique because of the vertical emphasis. We want for the people in that room to be honed in on worshiping them individually with their God. It is not about your neighbor. It's not about the person beside you. That room's not about connecting with neighbors. It's about connecting with God. That's the vertical reference. So whenever I give the call to worship, the lights go down because it creates a spotlight effect on the stage. People are now not just singing blindly these lyrics like we do to pop stars and, you know, rock stars of old or songs we just like the beat to, quote unquote, but we create the spotlight effect on the stage during the call to worship through singing because we want people to be focused on the lyrics, for them to be conscientious of what they're singing, and dimming the lights helps with the vertical response there. It helps to emphasize lyrics above all other things, because that's what we're doing. We're singing lyrics. They matter. Now, whenever we get up for the sermon time, because that's what comes next, as we plan out the hour, maybe you haven't noticed, but they certainly do, the lights come back on. Why? Because now we're worshiping through the sermon. We got a lot of note takers at First Salina. Praise God. We've done all we can creatively to create special avenues to make new note takers through our journals. Well, you want the lights on so that you can look down at your scripture that I invite you to bring out every week, and you can take notes. Cody, you said it so well. The lights are a tool to make sure that we are worshiping. If you are of the persuasion that you want the lights on all the time, there are great churches here in North Texas for you. So if that is bothering you to the degree that it's actually distracting you from connecting with God, then come and talk to us. You know, this isn't an avenue for us to speak indirectly, but hopefully an avenue to speak directly with people. I would love to talk to you about why we do that if you have more questions about it. But I just wouldn't want for someone to walk in and go, why are the lights on? Why are the lights off? Isn't Jesus the light of the world? It's like, hey, y'all, we pastors, there's a lot of thought that goes into these things. Everything we do is planned, and there's a lot of thought that's gone into the lights, the production, the music, sermon selection, sermon series, graphic design, and all of it in the worship center is vertically driven. Go into a horizontal room, lights are going to be on 100% of the time because that's where you connect with other people. And horizontal rooms called connect groups.
It made me think, so if Cody were to tell me he had a special date night plan for us, which we are married, by the way, if y'all don't already know that, there's a couple restaurants that I can think of that I would assume he's probably planning to take me to. None of them are Whataburger, right? with all the lights up and all the busy, like that would be disappointing, right? But when we walk in,
we're going to Whataburger tonight.
I have a coupon. When we walk in though, and there's a candle on the table, the ambience is different. Like everything about that mood and that atmosphere is so that he and I could focus on each other. We're not bringing the kids. Naturally, we have fewer distractions because there's intentionality around that space. And that's how I feel like it is with worship, right? Like there's a lot of intentionality, like the two of you have just shared so well. He's not taking me to a dimly lit restaurant to hide me so that people don't know that I'm with him. He's doing it because he cares, and there's a lot. We want to encourage each other to be able to focus on each other.
Yeah. Once again, everybody, if you're trying to make connections in the worship center, it's not unique to First Salina. It's the design of every church you go to. I would even argue almost cross-denominationally. The worship center is not where you build relationships. So if the light is not about spiritual things, but about relational things, what relationship? It's not each other. It's your relationship with God. So it would be a very low bar on yourself if you thought, if I smile today while I'm singing a song, then that means I connected with the next generation. It's like, I'm sorry, that's probably the same person that says that my way of sharing the gospel is holding the door for someone. Well, I'm very sorry. Opening the door for someone does not get to the resurrection. And it's just a huge leap there. Like exactly zero times have you done a kind act for someone and the person go, you know what? The tomb was empty on the third day. You see what I'm saying? Like it's just that like Christians will spiritualize everything. And hey, it's not always about the spiritual things, but it is always about the relational things. And what that room designed for relationally is not each other, is for you and God. So then what is dimming the house lights? Because it's not all lights. It's to focus on the lyrics. It's so that you would be bold enough if you're not a singer. And not everybody is. Most men aren't, I'll be honest. But I bet if we turn those lights off and a man was moved by the lyrics they had began to read, at least they'll start moving their lips. Here's how confident I am. I watch it every week. Turn those lights up. The ones with beards won't be singing.
The same can be said for the sound. The sound is the same way. You know, we keep everything at safe levels. It's the decibel reading is well below where, you know, it needs to be. But the same argument can be made for a little bit of a louder room, just because more people are going to be more likely to be comfortable, especially lost people. And that's who we want in our church. The lost person or the person far from God. You know, those people who are coming in and maybe new believers, they're going to be a little more comfortable actually interacting and participating. If maybe it's a little bit dimmer, maybe it's a little bit louder, they're going to be more likely to participate.
Mm-hmm. Well, what a great example of someone giving us a good question to interact with, because unless you're super dialed in or you have worked on a church staff, most likely you had no idea that that level of thought went into what we're doing during that hour. And it is. And now you do know.
Yeah, it brings out a lot of passion, ministerial passion. My challenge to the person that asked this question, again, no, like, this is a good question. My challenge to you, anybody who struggles understanding the methodology of any of our ministries, is go serve in those ministries. Because I promise, if you're in there and you're serving and you're helping us, we're going to tell you why we're doing what we're doing. You will understand to the nth degree why it is that we're doing what we're doing. So that would be my encouragement. So that brings us to our final question today. And on your sheet, it just says, Michael, surprise. I didn't bring anything for you. I have nothing, no gifts to offer. But I wanted us to interact with this live. You know, on Sunday, Pastor Jacob, you told a parable, right? Was that something you created?
Yes.
Like, you made it up and get it from somewhere?
Mm-mm.
Well, it was a really good story. And a parable is just a story that just illustrates a spiritual point. And Jacob used this. It was such a great summary of the sermon and the passages that we were going over. And it finally hit home for me as I watched people for years in Scripture. And I get so frustrated when people get to hear these parables, these stories from Jesus that have such depth, a spiritual depth to them. And you get frustrated because all the time you see in Scripture, they leave and then they just stop thinking about it. And that's what makes parables great. It's the more time you spend with them, especially the parables from Jesus, the more time you spend with them, the more depth you see, the more spiritual lessons you learn. And so I actually just want us to kind of interact with this live. I know you guys didn't know this was coming. I want us to listen to the parable and kind of talk about it. So here it is.
There was once a little boy who loved to get the attention of people. You might know this little boy. But there was once a little boy, he loved getting the attention of people. He loved their praise. And in the neighborhood, he loved when all the other kids paid him attention. But one day, he had done his last trick, and he had told his last joke. And the neighborhood kids, they didn't pay attention to him anymore. Well, while his father was away at work, for his father had given him so much, he went and looked for things in the house to give as gifts so the young boys in the neighborhood would pay him more attention. He began with the toys that he didn't play with. And that didn't really work so well. But then he started giving away the toys that he really liked. And that really worked. All the neighborhood kids were so happy to get the toys that were purchased by his father. In fact, they were so happy they threw a little mini neighborhood parade in his honor. And that parade was interrupted when his dad came home. And his dad interrupted the festivities and deeply disappointed, the father said, and it's on the screen, "You earned nothing. You gave for vanity and praise. You earned nothing. You gave for vanity and praise."
So I asked the question, So I began the parable by teeing up this little boy who wants attention. And then I asked, maybe you know this little boy. I was doing that not for you to get the thing external, because I'd already said this little boy who wants attention. I was hoping that the open heart would do exactly what Cody confessed that he did. It was the little boy, it was me. This isn't something I ever did whenever I was young, but what little boy, what little girl, it's not a gender thing, it's just a child, doesn't want attention. I know exactly zero kids that want that. I know zero kids who have no desire for attention. What I was trying to do at the opener of that was to get people's attention by hopefully connecting some relatability to the little boy just by knowing one attribute. that they craved attention.
So the thing that really struck me when I listened to it this morning, and I always listen to the sermon again when I'm trying to interact with these questions, and the thing that really stood out to me was that final statement from the father of when he just said, "You earned nothing." He did all of these things, and it just took me to my life and all the effort and time and priorities that I have set and done to make myself happy, and there was no payoff. Like, what a waste. And I think about the opposite way when I do any of those things for the Lord, and the payoff is so life-altering. My wife and I talk about this all the time. You know, when you're on a date, like you talked about earlier, Anna, we typically talk about two things, our kids and like where we've been the last many years. My wife and I have been married for 16 years, and we still do this every time we go out on a date. And sometimes when we take stock of our lives and we think about the little things that we made conscious decisions to do that were God-focused, and the payoff of those things to bring us where we are today, is just, it always amazes us. And we sit there on these dates and just think and ponder, like, man, God is so good to us. But then I personally and privately think about all the things that I did along the way, all those many years that were just to make myself happy, and they led to frustration, marital conflict, conflict with my kids, and just such a disparity between the two.
I think it's funny that he didn't purchase any of the things himself, but he still gave away the bad ones first.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't cost him anything to give away the good ones, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. we all prioritize that when we're weighing out decisions, right? The least resistance is always our first option that we tend to go for.
That makes me so very grateful because to hear you say that, Anna, because the thing about a parable is that you don't waste lines in a parable. It's supposed to be a very short, pithy, repeatable story that hones in on spiritual teachings, and each line should hit a different level.
Mm-hmm.
Like a parable, a good parable, is an attempt to do that. And I'm certainly not saying this is a good parable. It's very honoring, Michael, that you want to talk about it more. Thank you. But I appreciate you bringing that up, because what I was thinking about was the first thing that we offer up to the Lord is normally the thing that costs us personally the least. Mm-hmm. The first thing that we tend to offer up our neighbor, who, you know, we're trying to love as ourselves, is actually the thing that's easiest.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I believe that we have three things that are always up under our stewardship: our time, our talent, and our treasure. And it's very easy to give people the leftovers. So the toys that the boy doesn't play with anymore are symbolic of the things easiest for us to give up when it comes to time, talent, and treasure, the leftovers of those. But we all know that if your relationships are all built on the leftovers, those are normally temporary relationship or marginal relationships. And this little boy wants the undivided attention of all the people in the neighborhood. So he found out real quick that the toys that he doesn't play with are also going to be toys that other people don't play with. Your leftovers and time, talent, and treasure normally aren't blessings for other people, because they weren't blessings for you. They were what was left over. So that line of the parable might seem like a throwaway line, but it was hopefully, and Anna, you picked up on it very well, that was very intentional, that he struck out at first, giving away the toys easiest to give away.
This reminds me of a conversation we've had lately at our house, too. During busy seasons, it always comes up more, just about prioritizing our time. And as parents, we have been very intentional and try to set the example, but then also hold our kids accountable, especially now that they're getting old enough to serve, is that church isn't about your leftovers.
Mm.
Your Monday through Saturday commitments have nothing to do with things that you've taken responsibility for on a Sunday.
Mm.
And not because we have to work to earn, but that is our worship back. And our time, talent, and treasure, just like the little boy was ready to give his leftovers because he didn't care about them so much, too often we set our kids up to think it's okay to give God our leftovers too.
We had a good friend years ago back home in Georgia, one of my very good friends. He's a worship pastor. I hope he's listening. He gave me a really sweet piece of advice that we've kind of adopted in our house. Maybe not as his kids were all into sports and they like to do all kinds of things. Our kids are more artsy and musical, but his boys who went on to go to college and scholarships, they were amazing athletes. You know, they wanted to do every sport. If it was throwing a ball, they were doing it. If it was running, they were doing it. I mean, any sport, any season, all year long, all the time. And their policy at their house was, if you want to add a sport, cool, but you have to add in a serve somewhere else along with it.
Oh, cool idea.
And I always thought that was such a great idea because parents are so quick. I mean, we know this. We got three kids. We know this. It's so easy to be like, oh yeah, you can do that. Yeah, we've got the time. We can do that. But they miss the balance of what it looks like giving back, going back to what you're talking about with leftovers. And I just always thought that was so cool because, you know, kids wanted to go do track. Okay, great. So what are you going to do at the church? What are you going to do at the homeless shelter? What are you going to do at the soup kitchen? I mean, literally. And they stuck to that. And I always thought that was a really, really wise thing in helping hold your kids accountable, helping them balance.
That's parenting on purpose right there.
Yeah, very much so. It was really a cool
way to go.
Yeah.
You know, when we think of the idea of giving God our best and not our leftovers, it's one of those things where you're like, well, no, duh. Like, of course I want to do that. But as I'm even looking at my own life, student pastor here at this church, I'm like, dang, right? You know, I'm telling students every Sunday, every Wednesday night, like, yo, like, we got to be doing these things. Like, it's important. But it's so easy for us to choose God last because God loves us. He cares for us. He's never going to leave us nor forsake us. And we almost use that as like a cop-out of like, well, I'll give him what's left because he loves me. And it's like, no, that's a wrong perspective of like he deserves our best because of who he is and what he's done for us.
Amen. So there's both a theological and an anthropological reality to this that, you know, most people love the idea of, yeah, hey, God deserves my best. But don't forget who got the toys, the neighbor. So it's, does your neighbor get your best? This is insisting upon not just loving the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and soul, but loving your neighbor as yourself. Yeah. Right. All of the sermon series will build on itself. So don't forget that. And there was another thing, too, in here that I don't want you to, listener, team, don't feel as though my feelings are hurt if every little nuance isn't caught, okay? But before he gave the toys he didn't want to give them, he had told his last joke and he had done his last trick. Normally, with our behavior, what we'll first try to do is do all things within our power before we get things from outside of us. Because don't forget, the toys were given to him from whom? His father. So he had told his last trick and his last joke. It's supposed to put yourself in the mindset of is that, okay, the little boy is really at the end of himself, and he realizes that I'm going to have to borrow from something to give. So let me go to this place in the house. Don't go within my own heart, my own creativity. Let me go outside of myself and start giving what really belongs to someone else. Then we got to the toys. First, the toys that, because your time, your talent, and your treasure are all gifts from God, every one of them. You cannot add one more second to your life. Your talents are fixed within your personality, your giftings. Your talents are given to you from birth. And yes, even your treasure, though that there's a freedom to your choices, some of it better than others, but make no mistake, there's way too many situations in this complicated world that have to align up for you to have treasure that are outside of your control. Those are gifts from God. So I don't want to take a huge leap back, but a little small step back that we're officially in a part of the parable where we're looking outside of ourselves.
And isn't that the the life we should be looking for, right? I mean, that is the life of a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Jesus has been saying this whole time, and that's what you've been leading us through.
Yeah, yeah. That uniquely beginning with the Beatitudes, are we in a place after we take a look at that portrait and the blessed attitude of dependence, the blessed attitude of desire, and the blessed attitude of doing are all things that we have come to the conclusion we got to look external.
It really is the best sermon ever.
It really is the best sermon ever. Well, thank you again for another week of amazing questions. And team, thank y'all so much for interacting with me and interacting with these questions. It's a fun part of our week, but also a challenging part of our week. I was so encouraged at the response in the service whenever I had asked, hey, have you guys gotten a chance to catch the podcast, and the crowd erupted. That was really encouraging, wasn't it? So please, y'all, don't hesitate at all. Keep sending us those questions. Like, subscribe. We would love to keep this platform going as long as we think it's helpful to our people. We would hope to see you this week at First Salina. Our service starts at 10:30. The text for this weekend is going to be one of my all-time favorites. It's Matthew chapter 6, verses 5 through 15. It's where the Lord teaches us how to pray. So the sermon title for this weekend will be Shining Our Light on the Topic of Prayer.